Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, June 30th, 1945, 1,700 New York City newspaper delivery workers walked out at the beginning of what would end up being a 17-day strike by newspaper delivery men and women during the final days of World War II and at the peak of newspapers' power in New York and around the country. This was also sort of the beginning of an era marked by numerous labor strikes, including several in the news industry. So a bit of a forgotten moment, this newspaper strike, but one that touches on a lot of big mid-century themes. So here to discuss it all is, as always, Nicole Hemmer of Columbia. Hello, Nikki.
Hey, Jody.
And Jane Costin of Vox is with us again for one more episode. Hello, Jane.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So this is one of those episodes where we can just try and recreate the moment because it is, you know, in so many ways a different time. Jane, first of all, we're talking about a New York City in which there are 8 daily newspapers. So I will ask you of The Sun, The World Telegram, The Journal American, The Daily News, The Post, The New York Times, The Herald Tribune, and The Mirror, which would you have preferred to work for?
It's challenging because my first thought was like, the New York Times. I'm like, this is the New York Times that at this time, you know, is still describing Ida B. Wells as this like vicious mulatto woman. I think that one of the challenges when we think about this era is thinking about how each of these papers existed in a context and existed with a very particular audience. And so much of this newspaper era is not necessarily the newspapers battling outwardly. I think when we're talking about the media in 2020, there's the media and its opposition is people who hate the media. And this time, it's the media fighting against the media, fighting against the media, fighting against the media. And I think that that's something that you see from the strike that was so interesting is that this is a group of papers and the people who work for those papers striking as one, as part of a unified industry that is not divided by who writes for whom. And so, you know, in answer to your actual question, I don't know if I would have wanted to write for any of these papers.
Fair enough.
You know, at this time, this does not sound like, you know, perhaps a fantastic time to be doing this. But I do think it's interesting thinking about a media environment that in some ways has shifted. You know, I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio. And when I was a kid, there were two papers. There was the Cincinnati Inquirer and the Cincinnati Post. And the Cincinnati Post was the evening paper. And the Cincinnati Post no longer exists. But that desire for information still does. It's just now people are doing it elsewhere and doing it in other forms, doing it in some ways in worse forms, perhaps, than they were before. But it's interesting to me that this was a time at which New York could support 7 papers, or at least 7 papers. But I would also argue that New York probably still could in a media environment that is not this one.
And just to add some tidbits to the context of this very different time, some of those newspapers had circulations that are kind of mind-blowing. Like the Daily News had 2 million people a day and 4 million on the weekends reading it when the strike hits. We'll talk about this in a minute, but people are lining up to purchase the paper straight off the printing press. So, Nikki, what catches your eye about this story?
Well, so, I mean, part of it is that I think of all of the other newspapers in New York. I mean, we're just talking about daily newspapers here, and we're not talking about non-English language newspapers or the Amsterdam News or these other newspapers that served different communities throughout New York. They were sort of exempted from the strike in a lot of ways. But I also think about the timing, right? It's 1945, and we're actually in the middle in 1945, of the end of World War II. It hasn't quite ended by the time the strike happens, but also a major strike wave that is building across the U.S. because during the war, labor unions had kind of worked hand in hand with businesses to help keep wages down, to help keep things in production. There were wildcat strikes, but there weren't any sort of official strikes. And now that the war is coming to an end, now that inflation is going out of control, over the course of 1945 and 1946, there are millions of Americans who are on strike because of how bad the economy is and because of how suppressed their labor power has been. So this is a part of that story too.
I think that the story we tell ourselves about the Second World War is about Americans coming together organically to stand together against the Axis powers of Germany and Japan, when what you see, as Nicole so rightly brings up, is that labor concerns are very purposely tamped down. And the newspaper strike begins in June 30th. the war against Imperial Japan is still going on until August. The victory in Europe had been declared a couple of weeks earlier, but the war is still taking place. And, you know, my grandfather was on a ship headed to Okinawa at this time. And so I think it's interesting how this kind of gets past the myth we've been told about the Second World War and gets at the labor concerns that were purposefully silenced during this time.
And as a media story itself, I mean, you know, some of the other things that it teaches us about the environment at the time. Well, first off, newspapers did survive this one. There was another strike in 1966 where there were other pressures, and it actually did serve as a sort of extinction event for a lot of newspapers. And I think we're seeing now, certainly, that when the news industry slows down, as it has been this year, we're going to see a lot of outlets not come back. But, you know, here there's still newspapers still working, and some of the stories about people lining up for blocks and blocks and blocks to get the newspapers directly off of the presses because they weren't being distributed are kind of remarkable. This was also the era, and I will say this because I'm a former WNYC employee, but this was also the era in which Mayor LaGuardia started to really go on the radio, and he had actually read comics for the kids of New York City regularly on WNYC. So, you know, again, when you have these moments, it sort of scrambles the media environment.
Yeah, it's a really interesting moment for that reason. Like, people could still get news from their radios, they could get it from newsreels, but there was such a loyalty and such a habit of newspaper reading that they were still seeking out copies of these newspapers. And a lot of it had to do with, like I said, habit, but also, remember, some of these newspapers represented your political party. So the Herald Tribune was what was read by Republicans. And right. So it's part of just your politics to go and buy a copy of the Herald Tribune. And so this strike disrupts a lot of that. And you can see in the people who are flooding into these places where they can go buy these newspapers that are no longer being delivered to them, how much hunger there is for newspapers, even when there are alternatives.
Let's wrap up and do a couple also on this days. So also on this day in 1918, on June 30th, Eugene Debs, Nikki, have we talked about Eugene Debs on this podcast
yet? We have
yet?
Not Maybe. Yet.
That's kind of surprising. So Eugene Debs, prominent socialist, pacifist, he was arrested on charges of violating the Espionage Act. We'll find a time to do Eugene Debs at some point, but you want to do a little bit on this 1918 arrest?
Yeah, well, the arrest leads to a successful prosecution, and that means in 1920, when he runs for president again, he is running from prison. And he gets more votes in 1920 running from prison than any socialist candidate in U.S. history.
All right, so there is hope for all those people currently in the government who will end up in prison. You can still run from prison if you so wish. And then 1971, Ohio becomes the 38th state to approve lowering the voting age to 18. This ratifies the 26th Amendment. We now have an 18-year-old voting age. Jane, we don't do predictions on this show, but will the voting age ever get lowered again?
I would guess not. Okay. But I have been frequently wrong and would embrace being wrong again. I think that, especially because I think that in the midst of the Vietnam War, I remember my mom had a button that said something to the extent that, you know, I'm too young to vote, but just the right age to die.
Right.
And that was part of why this amendment became so critical at that particular point, where when you have people who have been sent off to Vietnam who are not old enough to vote on whether or not they should have been sent to Vietnam or whether or not to take part in that process whatsoever. I think that was striking for many people.
Yeah, the button now would be like, I'm too young to vote, but not young enough to juul or something. It just doesn't, it just doesn't ring in the same way.
It's interesting. I've joked before that if America lowers its drinking age, which I think would probably be a very good idea, it just that the first 6 months of that would be very bad.
Yep.
Right. No one would have a great time, as evidenced by anyone who has ever attended high school ever.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Jane Costin, thank you as always. And thanks for being on these last three episodes.
Thanks so much for having me. I've really enjoyed myself.
And Nicole Hammer, thanks to you.
Thanks, Jody.
So thanks again to Jane Costin of Vox. You can read her work on Vox.com or listen to her on The Weeds and elsewhere. And yeah, follow her on Twitter at CJane87. This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX. You can find out lots more about the show at thisdaypod.com. You can also follow us on social media at thisdaypod, Instagram and Twitter at thisdaypod. Each day you will get a few posts about interesting things that happened on that day. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Up next, we're going all the way back to the signing of the Declaration of Independence and the one person who did not sign the Declaration of Independence. A really interesting story that's coming up on Thursday with a really fun special guest. I will wait to reveal it until Thursday's episode. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Well, the strike isn't over. So I suppose the children have been waiting to hear something about their funnies. Do you like them? Oh, I get a great kick out of them. Here's Dick Tracy. Let's see what Dick Tracy is doing.